All right, so this month we continue with our exploration of the paramis, these 10 perfections, and exploring equanimity. Now, when Tuari and I kind of decided upon this and laid out the year, we didn't really think about November and the election timing, but it was actually, I think it's a good month to bring this forth because we probably will need equanimity. It's a quality that is, in some ways, it's really essential to our practice, this quality of equanimity, of balance, of this equally near all things is one definition I'll explore tonight. It's a way of finding kind of a ballast that our happiness or sense of ease is less dependent upon the conditions of our life. And it's also one of those topics that we can easily get a little bit twisted up around. We can think of kind of confuse equanimity with being maybe distant, maybe being aloof, disconnected. Those are some of the distortions. Or sometimes we're looking for some way to find, get our heads above water because we're so awash with the intensity of our lives or of the world. So equanimity, if you look at the dictionary version, mental calmness, composure, evenness of temper, especially in a difficult situation. Composure, mental calmness, evenness of temper. Now, this quality of equanimity, we have to also be aware of this very strong tendency as human beings to try to move away from what's painful, to try to escape from that. And sometimes we can misuse spiritual teachings like equanimity as a way to kind of avoid our pain. Right? And this is an important thing. We talked about this last talk around loving kindness. And sometimes there's a spiritual bypassing that can sometimes come in as we're trying to adopt this image of being a loving, kind person and denying the harshness of our heart. You know, so the humanness, the completeness is being willing to open to this whole expression of ourselves. And equanimity can kind of sound like a way to kind of escape the pain, kind of numb ourselves out, or just not be aloof enough that we don't feel it. And this can really sound enticing. You know, it's like, oh, I really want that state. And sometimes we start to adopt that quality of being equanimous, even though in reality we may not be so much. There's a animated movie I watched. I was going through my notes and I did a talk on this back in 2017. There's a movie that I watched about that time, animated movie called The Song of the Sea. It's an interesting movie. It's probably not very well known, but basically there's this kind of magical person, kind of basically a witch is the way she's portrayed, but she really cares about people's pain. But her solution is to turn them into stone so they don't feel their pain. So she goes around turning out, she feels their suffering, and she does this spell on them, and they turn into this stone. And of course, you know, the arc of the story is eventually she realizes the difficulty of this and people come out of stonehood back into fully feeling, but they're feeling the pain at the same time. So this is one way that we can distort equanimity is I want to try to turn myself into stone so I don't feel. As Simon and Garfunkel say that from their I think it's the Song of Silence, I touch no one and no one touches me. I am a rock, I am an island, and a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries. So if you start to feel like your practice, you're feeling kind of a little closed off, your heart's a little sheltered, protected, that's a good time to bring these other qualities like loving kindness in. I think it's important to realize that equanimity isn't this kind of solo practitioner. It actually runs with all the other Brahma Viharas, these other divine abodes of loving kindness, of compassion, of sympathetic joy. This is really this engagedness of the heart in relationship to this human condition. You know, this basic friendliness of heart, this quality of warmth of heart, of metta. this quality of compassion, that when we see suffering in ourselves or another person, that compassion comes forth. And sympathetic joy, the rejoicing in someone else's success, someone else's well-being, without any strings attached. And Sharon Salzberg often mentioned that equanimity is like the secret ingredient that helps them all work, helps them not shift into some of their near enemies, like pity instead of compassion. And the quality of like, it's not quite fully the depth of these Brahma Viharas if it doesn't have equanimity. So equanimity means we can't exclude the heart. We can't exclude, you know, this sense of being human, all this pain of being human. Now, to do this, it's tricky, though. It's such an interesting thing, because how do we balance equanimity with really when we really care about something? We really are invested in something, like the election. Probably most people really want the election to go one way or another. I mean, I'm not assuming that everyone is of the same mind as me. I try to hold that in a more balanced way. But there's so much investment, so much our hearts really want things to go the way we want to go. And there's a lot of fear if it doesn't go the way we want. How does equanimity come in? How does equanimity come in when we have to act or when we need to act? Because it does seem like it's such a passive quality. And so often it's this shift of kind of this perspective that we explored last talks around the assembly of the saw, where the Buddha has these really beautiful images of nature and calling forth kind of the inherent vastness, inherent spaciousness, and also the quality of the self being so much bigger than this narrow sense. And this is one of the ways that equanimity starts to come forth. I think each of the Brahma Viharas can be entry points into equanimity. Like, for example, compassion, and how compassion, wisdom, equanimity all start to work together as our practice matures. One example, I was doing this year-long class on using death and dying as a spiritual practice with my teacher, Rodney Smith. And so each month we would meet and he would give us homework. And one of the homeworks was to go to a graveyard and to look at all the gravestones and reflect on all the people who have died and all the tears shed for their deaths. And this is the point in this process that we were going through, that there's a lot of heaviness around death that was starting to come forth, my grief over my own death, those that I love, and it started to feel a little overwhelming. But by doing this simple exercise and really reflect, okay, here's this stone, gravestone, and this person has died at this date, and someone cried about that. Someone felt the pain of that loss. And to see all the countless gravestones, and to reflect on all the gravestones and graveyards in the world and throughout time. As I did that process, it was very amazing. It was very interesting and amazing to watch this painfulness of grief, my personal grief, anticipatory of my death and others' death, to expand into this shared experience, that this is shared with each one of us here in this room, each one of us here on the call. And this started to bring this other quality, that this is part of this human nature. And so it was less of my pain and my sorrow and more of this shared human experience. And this is a movement from kind of that narrowness of personal pain into the balancing of equanimity. So compassion became something much more universal instead of this narrow quality of attachment. So equanimity. It's interesting doing this talk the night before the election. For some reason, the last time we had one of these candidates running, I happened to draw the straw to give a talk on Tuesday night when we used to meet on Tuesday. Election night Tuesday, inauguration Tuesday. And it was there was a lot of intensity. A lot of people were really upset and worried and hurting with that experience. And here we are again with another election around the corner, literally. So again, I'm trying to hold this, you know, honoring those who may, you know, have a different belief than myself, who I want to win. Because both sides really have, it's a great opportunity to practice, is one bottom line of it. Some of these really intense things in our life, these very distressing and stressful situations, they're points of practice. Right? And it's not because, you know, that's what we should do, it's because it's actually a really helpful tool. It actually helps us navigate these things, whether it's kind of a big societal thing, a big nationwide experience like a presidential election, or if it's something much more personal like your own personal pain or a diagnosis or a loss that you're dealing with. That's when the practice really shines. It really comes forth. And if we have a regular practice, we can call upon that reserve. We can call upon this quality. We often find that we're surprised. I certainly have been, by how I meet things in a different way, in a more wise, compassionate, more equanimous way. Now, equanimity in the election is really interesting because regardless of which side of the political spectrum you find yourself, we have a lot of attachment to how things will be or might be. We have a lot of attachment of how we want things to be. There's a deep yearning. There's a lot of fear. Maybe there's excitement and hope. There's all these qualities that arise. And those seem like the opposite of equanimity in some ways. So how do we start to bring these together? How do we practice with them? What starts to allow equanimity to grow? I think it's really challenging to have equanimity with something that we're really in the fear of it or the hope for it, they're really the ideas and the concepts around it, the beliefs around it, because we're really relating through our minds, through the world of thought. We're trying to project into the future of how the future will be. We're drawing upon the past of how the past will be. And I think equanimity, one of the maybe a good entry point is it's actually available when we connect deeply to this present moment. To actually what's here right now. And that's what the homework focuses on for those who got it online and will have some copies here in the room. And so grounding ourselves in this present moment, equanimity often can be accessed in that. If we go into the future of how the future will bring, what's going to happen tomorrow and the next years, it's much harder to find that quality of equanimity. You go into the past based, you know, remorse or regret or longing. It's also harder to find this quality of equanimity. It shows up here in this very present moment. And the reason for this is that our mind's idea of how the future will be and our memory of how the past will be has a layer of abstraction. It's not actually here right now. In this room, other than what we bring forth. And so it's harder. Equanimity is almost something that shows up in relationship to what's here. It shows up in relationship. Okay, it's too hot in the room. Can we be equanimous to it? You know, can you think about it being equanimous if the room's too hot next week? Or how about last month when it was too cold? You know, can we, the room's fine, I think, to myself, by the way. But depends. But you know, you may not feel that way. But how can we actually meet the circumstances of how the moment is? And I think it's the present moment. If we really look at it, we don't actually spend a lot of time there. We don't actually have a deep relationship to the present moment, even though that's where we live. This is kind of ironic. That we're living, we can only live in the present moment. And yet, we're kind of a little bit aloof from that, a little bit distanced from it. We're leaning into the future, leaning into the past. So learning to develop this connection to the present moment is one of the main arts of meditation. What's this breath feel like right now? What's this sound What's the sensation in this body? And even that, it's so easy to add layers upon it. You might judge, okay, that's my shoulder pain, and I got that shoulder pain from that sports injury this many years ago. I add things onto it. I hear a sound. It's like, why do they have, they should have no sirens on meditation night. You know, something like that. We can go down that. Even labeling it as siren is a little bit of an abstraction, a little bit of a layering away from that. Right? So having this, when we're really connected to the present moment, there's a wordless quality to it. And as we learn to meditate and our meditation deepens and matures, we start to develop more and more of a relationship to that. Simply that place of ease, that sense of being completely connected to the how the moment is. Because that present moment, if we're able to open to it in a full and deep way, it has a vastness to it, an immensity to it. As a simile of saw, of the simile of the saw that we were explored in the last couple of weeks, it's like that depth of stillness, the depth of the earth, of the sky, of nature itself, that's connected to this present moment. And it's tricky. It's tricky to connect with that. Because when we do that, something interesting happens to that sense of you, that sense of self. That sense of self becomes much less established, much less defined. Becomes thinner, more opaque. And in that thinning of self, many of us, if not all of us, get a little bit freaked out by that. Because that sense of self has been this constant companion, this way that I interpret the whole world. So it has this utility, it really helps us do our jobs and navigate the world. And it also creates a tremendous amount of suffering for ourselves. So in one way, to look at equanimity has to do with this sense of self. The more established it is, the more likely we're going to have, go into the future, go into the past, have a lot of preferences and liking and disliking. So all that creates that sense of self. Equanimity goes a little further away. Right? When we relax into the present moment, right? Kind of let the future take care of itself for the time being, let the past take care of itself, actually to connect deeply with this present moment, we become a little bit less defined. Now this leads to something that Christina Feldman said in one of her retreats here. She was a yearly teacher at Seattle Insight. I consider her one of my mentors as a teacher with a lot of depth of wisdom, you know, 40, 50 years of practice under her belt. She defined equanimity as being equally near all things. Being equally near all things. So what happens to our preferences? What happens to our likes and dislikes? You know, do we discount those? Do we throw those away? Do we not allow to be passionate about anything anymore for practitioners? I mean, this is where our minds can go. So let's explore this territory. Now, what she said also in relationship to equanimity, we develop equanimity, she said, by withdrawing our insistence that the moment be different. Okay, She has a nice British accent, so, and she tends to say things in a very poetic way. We develop equanimity by withdrawing our insistence the moment be different. That the moment be different. So one gateway into equanimity is to examine this argument we have with how the present moment actually is. Okay, so that this present moment. So again, I'm kind of trying to reframe us because we're so used to thinking in terms of what's the next moment going to be? What's the next day going to be? What's the next election going to be? The next presidency? We just keep leaning into the moment, the future, I should say. This helps us navigate the world. But for most of us, it's not really an option. It's more of a habit. It's a way that we actually orient to the world, and we forget to actually connect to this present moment. So this argument with how the present moment is. And this is interesting because it comes up this idea of passivity versus action, right? If I'm fully not arguing with how the moment is, isn't that giving up my agency? Isn't it giving up my potential for action in the world, for social justice, for standing up for what's right, you know, for doing my work, for making good in the world? If I accept things just how they are, then, you know, what about what takes care of the world? What about who stands up to bullies and to tyrants and all those things? And this is where this is a really important piece of our practice. I think almost everyone asks that question. I've certainly asked that myself. And I think it comes back again to what's our relationship to the present moment? Can we really connect with how the moment is right now? And in that connection, that becomes the springboard from wise action. If you don't fully connect with how the moment is, we're tending to connect through our prejudices, our projections, our future worries, our past remorses. We're not really basing our actions on the present moment. So I think that's one of the keys that I found very helpful with this. And again, it has this really dramatic and significant consequence for that sense of self if we really fully connect to the present moment. Because we become less defined. If we fully, deeply connect to it, that sense of self falls away. That sense of self falls away, from the sense of self's perspective, that's annihilation. We don't exist anymore. And yet, from the heart's perspective, it's like returning to the depth of interconnection. So coming back to this question of action, how do we actually act in the world? Because again, the sense of self is so tied to action. It's kind of we're acting from that sense of perspective. And Christina Feldman also had this phrase she used. She called it the navigational self. The navigational self that knows how to get to Sims, knows how to do your job, how to navigate parenthood or whatever it might be. It helps you know how to do things, right? But there's this absolute sense of that self being just something that arises, you know, based on a tool that's needed. So let's try to make this more concrete. I'm getting a little abstract here. So let's say I'm walking around barefoot at night in an unfamiliar place and I stub my toe. I stub it hard enough, I actually break my toe, right? So there's a lot of pain that's arising in that moment. So I'm connecting right to the felt sense, the actual middle of that moment's experience. There's a lot of pain, a lot of discomfort. All right. And I can have equanimity with that. I can open to that. Okay, this is how the moment is. The moment is filled with pain. The moment's filled with this discomfort. And from that connection with how that pain is, I can tend to it. I can see, okay, I need to see the ER, I need to get a cast, whatever it might be. And yet, most of us, when we stub our toe like that, and stubbing toes is an analogy for something, you know, all kinds of ways we can elaborate upon that. I start to, okay, who left this block here? Why didn't I turn the lights on? Why didn't I be more careful? Why was I so sleepy? Why do I have to get up and pee in the middle of the night? All these kind of going back to the past, blaming someone else, going into the future. What's the moment next? What am I going to do for work if I can't walk? Once if I lose my job, I can just elaborate upon that. Okay, so equanimity is not there anymore. Because I've gone into the movement of thought, I've gone into the movement into the future, I've gone into the past. But if I come back into the present moment, okay, this is what the moment is. Okay, there's this If I don't argue with this moment, if I stop wanting this moment to be other than it is, then I can start to tend to it. I can actually be in relationship to it. It's like they train medical emergency responders. The first thing they do is, you know, pause and kind of take in the whole scenario before they rush in, because they might miss someone else who's more hurt. They might miss a danger. They might, you know, tend to something that's really dramatic and miss the bleed that's life-threatening. Right? So this is that sense of pausing, connecting with how things are. Right? So tomorrow with the election, you know, who knows how it will go? Who knows how resolved it will be tomorrow? We can spend energy going into that future moment, or we can connect with what's this moment like right now? What am I actually feeling? Right? And when that moment arises, then we see, connect with it. What am I feeling? What's my experience? And then what's needed from that? Where does action flow from that? And for most of us, it's really hard to do that because we so much move into the thinking, into the worry or the hope, wherever we might, our minds might go around it. And so, can we find equanimity in the middle of this experience? Okay, I'm really nervous about the election. Okay, I'm seeing the map changing colors, and I don't like that color. I like this color. And, you know, I can just feel myself going into the future. That's the moment's experience, actually. Can I go right into the middle of that sense of worry without adding to it, but just actually touching it? Okay, I'm really scared right now, or I'm really excited right now. Can I open to that experience? And in that opening, you can start to see equanimity starts to be possible, this allowing of the moment's experience. Doesn't discount or take away any potential for action. It allows us actually to find that place of balance. I think balance is one of these qualities of equanimity, which I think is so helpful, because when we have equanimity, we're able to actually adapt to how the situation is changing right in front of us, how we can actually meet that. As I shared a couple weeks ago, we had used a valet parking for the airport, came back, and they wrecked our car. And it was interesting to watch what came up, because I wasn't actually angry. I was just more like, okay, let me hear about that. What are we gonna do about this? And meeting the person was surprised I wasn't yelling and screaming at that. I wasn't trying to be nice. That was what was arose. And I think we can all start to call upon those own examples in our life, that there's a way that we're a little bit more patient, we're a little bit more listening, a little more kind than we normally would be. And there's this sense of balance that starts to come forth. There's a short little story by one of the students of Aikido founder. His name was Ueshiba, often called O Sensei. So one day, one of his students, his oldest students, was watching the master, this martial art, demonstrate the technique after technique. Throughout the demonstration, Ueshiba's balance appeared perfect. The student had been observing this since the first day he trained, striving unsuccessfully ever since to emulate the master's apparent perfection. At the end of class, he approached to the great teacher. "Sensei," he said, "I have to ask you a question. I've been training and training for years. Every day I train, I am off balance. Every technique, no matter how rudimentary, I'm always off balance. I watch you train, and you are never off balance. How do you do that?" No, said O Sensei, "this isn't true. I'm frequently off balance. I'm just very quick to get back on balance." This is Fearless Riding by William Kenover. To quickly get back on balance. And that's the dance of our practice, is that gateway. Where's the present moment? What's actually happening here? That helps us find that place of balance. And it's not like we can decide, okay, I'm going to be equanimity tomorrow 100%. It's going to be moment by moment. How do you reach this moment? How do you meet this moment? Can I regain that balance? Can I find this place of connection? I think the gateway is into the present moment. Just take feeling a breath, feeling the feet, and then seeing, okay, what can I do right now? What is needed? So equanimity is not a static thing. It's actually something that's alive. It's a relationship to how the moment is actually arising. So attend to the heart, making sure the heart isn't closed off, where there's not a sense of contraction or coldness or protection. Think about that witch turning people into stones to not feel their pain. Right? Pain, heart's available. Heart is connected. Heart is present. And yet there's this greater capacity, this greater knowing. Okay, this is life. Things come and go. There's praise and blame. There's fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments. Let those words settle. And let's hear from you. And as we sit here together, you might feel this play going into the future, going into the past. And yet the present's always here. This is the saving grace. Is actually nothing we have to attain or do a huge heroic leap. It's actually a relaxing into. All right, so I'm going to say a few words about the homework. So usually I would teach again next week, but Carrie Peterson will be here, and she'll have another talk on equanimity. But I wanted to give you homework anyway, because I care about you. So during the election tomorrow and the days following, call yourself back into the present moment. Call yourself back. Right? So you might feel like there's a strong pull into the future. And however it goes, there's going to be this pull coming back. Connect with the moment outside of your thoughts. Okay, what's this breath feel like? What's this contact of the feet? It's not discounting the reality of things. It's actually allowing you to develop this capacity to meet the reality much more clearly. Can we relax our argument with this actual moment we are experiencing? This tightness in the chest, this hope in the heart, whatever it might be, can I actually acknowledge it? And let your actions flow from that. So like there's just, it might take, depending on what's going on, it might take you a few moments to a few hours to try to connect with the present moment. But after a while, it can be something you just call upon. And actually, probably all of you can already do that. You just call upon that connection to the present moment. Then from there, act. But as you touch the present moment, let go of the impulse to act, the impulse to do anything, just for a moment or two. And then from there, see if something else arises. It might have been your original impulse. It might be changed a little bit. Maybe you say something a little bit different. Maybe you connect or see something in a different way. All right, so I'm curious to see what's out there in the room around this topic of equanimity, around the election. Yes, Jean's off out of the gate early. I'm on my way. Yeah, so we'll use the mic for those in the room, and online you can just raise your virtual hand.
Thank you for this talk. I find that probably the biggest hindrance to me and my relationship to equanimity is my relationship to control. Huh? I now have no control over the election. I voted a week ago. It's in someone else's hand now. It's not in mine. Yeah. So I have to let that go. But I realize that it's all invested in how closely I am connected to that control issue. Mm. And I wonder if you have anything that you might say about that to clarify it or help me in that struggle.
How does the control show up? Like, what's it? Is it like there's a? Are you getting into other people's business? Are you just that tightness? Is it the helplessness and not being in control?
I think there's a whole lot of helplessness about it.
Yeah.
I can only do what I can do. I'm responsible for myself. I cannot be responsible for anyone else's actions. I might try to be, but basically I think it's a sort of a helplessness.
I was asking my wife, we were, you know, traveling yesterday. Was it yesterday? I guess it was yesterday. And I was trying to get ready for this talk and asking her about equanimity. And, you know, if she had noticed if I'm any more equanimous than I used to be. And she basically said there's a lot around control, that I'm a lot less controlling than I used to be. And so part of the controlling, it's such a, each of these Brahma Viharas kind of bring forth kind of the opposite element. It helps you kind of as to start to notice those. And so with control, I mean, there's like the interpersonal control that you can let go of more easily. You know, kind of letting go, like leaving on time or controlling the circumstances and just kind of letting things kind of arise at their own pace, their own timing, and maybe not the way that you think they should. You know, because there's this, you know, most of us think, you know, I know the right way to do things. And if you're not doing it, I'm not helping you out by trying to control you to do it the right way. It's sometimes that's the internal logic that goes on. And so one way to play with it, there's so many different ways, but what I would suggest, Gene, is just kind of bring the sense of control right to the forefront of your meditation. Actually, so what I mean by that is start to, because usually we focus on the breath or the body. All those same tools translate into something like control, right? So start to really get to know the territory of control. How does it change the way that you perceive? How does it change your actions? How does it change the way that you're kind of interpreting the world, right? And so see it without trying to change it or judge it or alter it, but just to really understand the landscape and also understand, you know, the impact of those actions, and also start to see, you know, how effective is that control really? You know, because we have control, and then we also have impermanence. We have things coming and going. And it's like, sometimes I think that this, one of the fundamental things of the sense of self is trying to navigate this chaotic world. It's like, I have no idea what's going to happen. Let me create this, at least I can create this sense of self to try to navigate it. But even that sense of self is always falling away. You know, I get older and my capacity wanes, or I can't, these roles fall away. My children grow up and I don't, you know, there's all these things. I lose my job. I retire. My health changes. All of these things. Control is like, it's an illusion. But we try really hard to try to stop it. So part of it, you start to realize, well, you know, I can keep trying this pattern, but it's not really helping much. It is not really doing much other than making myself and everyone else unhappy. So part of it is trying to see that more clearly.
It does help when I'm able to recognize and own the fact that it never was under my control.
Yeah.
And never will be.
Yeah. And then you put something, so that's kind of interpersonal, and you put something like the election, okay? And you really want the election to go a certain way, is probably most of the country does. You know, we have maybe our side, we have their side, there's all this, but there's this heartfelt wanting things to go, and there's a fear of it not going that way. And so how do we open to that? How do we to meet that uncertainty? How do we trust? How do we surrender? How do we bring, when do we bring action forth?
Thank you.
All right. Do you see her, Cheryl?
Hi. I have a question about the news, because you talked a lot about like being in the present moment.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it's kind of like, what is the present moment when there's so much going on that you can read about at any time in the news? And like, for me, I'm always like, what's my responsibility to know what's going on? Is it my responsibility to know what's going on in Saudi Arabia? I don't know. So I guess, or even like with tomorrow, like whatever's going to happen, I'm probably just going to be like in my house perfectly fine. So it's kind of like, what actually is the present moment? Is it like just where you are? Or is it like what's happening on the other side of the world?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the way we, from a Dharma perspective, I mean, there's different ways we can answer that question, because there is, right now, there's a present moment. Everyone in the planet is having their own present moment. And there's sometimes it's really a beautiful moment, sometimes it's a horrific moment. But from a Buddhist perspective or Dharma perspective, we're kind of looking from our own, you know, how am I perceiving the world? How can I perceive the world in a more clear, direct way? And so when we actually use that definition, the present moment actually gets in some ways very limited. It's like, okay, just what are my senses picking up? What's actually right here, right now? Because, I mean, who knows what's happening right now somewhere else, even, you know, back home or even across town or even next door. There can be these whole different things. So it's not discounting all that. And that's an interesting question, too, because on one hand, we can just turn away from all that. And some of that, you know, some of it is helpful to kind of shelter us a little bit, because the news doesn't always have our welfare at heart. It's not like saying, oh, you've heard too much bad stuff. Let me give you some good stuff for a little bit. Get your mind more balanced. Or just like, here you go. You keep clicking this. Let's give you more and more and more. And we just get more and more amped up. So I think it's also having some kind of willingness to, and also the news just gives you a pretty biased view of the negative things in the world, right? So that's also something to reflect upon. I think what I would probably do is, do you look at the news like every day or a few times a day?
Why every day?
Yeah. Yeah. So you might just kind of play a little bit with it. Like maybe I'll look at the news, you know, every 2 hours or something, you know, and just kind of notice what that feels like, to give myself a little space around it, you know, or you can expand it to every, you know, a day or so, depending on, you know, like tomorrow might be an interesting way to play with it. Because probably a lot of us are going to be like, okay, what's... And, you know, the news people are going to give us, okay, they're going to kind of keep... I mean, we've been seeing this for the last few months, just they keep trying to find something to say about... They've already said it. They're just finding different ways of saying the exact same thing. So it's like we have our choices of how we are. But the present moment, from a meditative standpoint... Yeah, just what can I sense right here in this moment? And start to notice in that middle of that sensing, there's a potential for more peace, more space, more ease. Mind's going to want to pull forth into the future or past, but coming back, that's where that peace is. Does that help at all?
Yeah. It just also seems that could be a way that you could just turn off from the world. If you live a good life, you could just say, I don't want to think about that.
Yeah, and that's the other side of it. Yeah, you have to kind of hold both. Like, okay, if I turn away from life too much, if I'm disconnected, I don't know what's going on, what's really affecting the world at large, what's affecting my country, my state, neighborhood, city. Yeah, so it's finding that place of balance. Yeah.
Thank you.
And I think for each one of us, it's, you know, we kind of just, you know, just do trial and error, you know, go one way. Okay, that's too far that way. This is too far this way. Okay, what's kind of that balance point? Yeah, it's an important question. All right, anyone online like to ask or share anything? All right, if something comes up, just feel free to raise your virtual hand. All right, how about back here in the room? Yes.
Hi, thank you for the talk. I work in a creative field, and I think it's probably just a story I tell myself, but it's, you know, it's very difficult. And I have this idea that I need this great intensity in order to bring something into being that wasn't there before. And it has been my experience, actually, when I relax, you know, I meditate more in my week. I don't create as much, or I do a lot of half-baked things. So I'm trying to reconcile these experiences. It feels very important to be engaged in this creative work, but it's very hard, and I've never seen, I don't think I know anybody, actually, who goes about it in a equanimous way.
Yeah, it's, yeah, that, it is interesting, because yeah, so much of our, you know, the big, you know, breakthroughs or big expressions of creativity, there's often a lot of kind of emotional turmoil that kind of leads to those coming forth. Kind of maybe the kind of the instability or the kind of all this stuff that gives a lot of energy for that to come forth. And meditation does kind of cool things down. And, you know, there's creativity. Sometimes there's the quality. Another thing that sometimes comes up, just even around accomplishments, is sometimes we have a lot of passion for something, and it's kind of mixed in with, I'm kind of invested in really doing well on this and showing, you know, how good I am or wanting to grow. And at some point in meditation, we start to become less enamored with trying to make ourselves anything other than we are. We're kind of like become more content. And so it's like, okay, where's the energy I used to use to do all of these things? Is that part of what happens too?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, this question, in some ways it's this kind of limbo place that we start to get into, that there's one strategy that really worked, and then we start to kind of, that strategy stops working, but we haven't had the new way of coming forth, you know. And so we might play with this with the sense of intensity, that sense of you know, of really, what was your word? Really the passion?
Yeah, intensity.
Intensity, mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me more about that intensity. What's it feel like when you're creating?
It's a lot of energy, and it feels like I need to, speaking to the control question, like I have to move almost everything out of the way so that it has space to come into being, but that looks like controlling a lot of other things, pushing things away, making sure things fit in a certain container so that there's space.
And where does the intensity come from?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Because you create space for it, but where does it come from?
I don't know.
Is it coming from you?
Yeah. Yeah.
What part of you?
That I don't know.
Yes, there's a little bit of mystery or where that arises from. Mm-hmm. And so with all this dynamic of, you know, kind of cooling things down and being more equanimous and less controlling, that also creates a space too. So see if that space, and maybe just invite that forth. So, okay, you know, let myself something arise, and let me do it in a full-hearted way. Mm-hmm. I think that's one thing in our tradition that we don't do as well as some other traditions. Like you look at like Zen tradition, for example, there's lots of examples in Tibetan traditions of Buddhism that you really create from a kind of an awakened place. Mm-hmm. You know, that's part of the meditation. So it's like that there's, it flows from maybe a more empty place, but also a more, you know, rich place, more coming from nature itself. Mm-hmm. And so see if you can, how can I be fully embodied with this? Because probably part of that intensity, I imagine, is that there's a way that everything gets hooked up, like everything becomes just that act of creation, mm-hmm. right? And there's a unification that comes from that. Mm-hmm. And that's what we try to do as meditators, to have this unification. And our tradition, we just sit there and we're a little passive in it. But at some point, we can learn to bring that same quality forth. Mm-hmm. So just play with that. How can I be wholehearted in this experience? Okay. How can I bring my whole being to bear? And that you might actually find that meditation actually allows more access to that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's yeah, really so helpful. Try it out and report back. What else? Yeah, I really appreciate questions because it helps, you know, helps me connect with what's pertinent for you, what you're exploring, and also the questions help touch everyone else in different ways.
Hello.
Hello.
So I kind of had a question with the subject of equanimity. Often I'm able to understand it on a conceptual level in the moment. However, I struggle to integrate that into feeling, like actually kind of I can conceptually understand that my preferences won't really affect my well-being, but I don't feel that. I feel it's often overcome by like a sense of fear that kind of is overpowering sometimes. Mm. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on how I could kind of transcend that conceptual understanding into like feeling.
Yes, that's a great question. Yeah, because the conceptual piece, it sounds really cool. It's conceptually like, oh, I'm equally near all things and I can kind of get the handle. But when life is actually in our face, sometimes it seems like, okay, that concept doesn't meet us, doesn't meet the situation. So what you might try doing is when you're feeling that moment of fear, and this is what I often do myself is when I feel like an intensity, it's actually just what I talked about in the talk really, is okay, can I connect with that moment just how it is? Okay, so what does the fear actually feel like? So it's kind of, in some ways, it's bringing quality of mindfulness to meet the fear, bringing this, a little bit of spaciousness around the fear itself. Right, because if we're in the middle of the fear, it tends to drive us into thinking. It tends to, there's sensations, there's emotions, and just kind of this swirling mess. And we don't have much perspective on it. We're kind of in the middle of it. So it's like stepping back just a little bit to observe the actual experience of being afraid. So if you have this concept, I shouldn't even be afraid, I should be equanimous, that's going to make the whole thing not work so well. Right, because we're discounting how we actually are. We're trying to make ourselves be something other than we are. So the kind of the counterintuitive thing is to say, okay, let's allow the fear to be just how it is. Okay, so there's a part of us that starts to open and experience it. That part has equanimity in it. There's a some way we can think of it as there's a part of it that's just this. It's okay with it, even though this is a really sucky situation. I really don't want it to be here. There's still a part that's kind of okay with it. It's like, oh, wow, that's interesting that this is happening. And you start to notice that quality. Sometimes you notice it in really intense situations, like, oh, I'm about to get in a car accident. Isn't that interesting? You know, there's an earthquake. Wow, I wonder how it's going to be like when this building starts to fall apart. I mean, and those are experiences I've had. It's like, where did that come from? You know, I'm concerned for my well-being, but, oh, wow, this is interesting. And those allowed a capacity to meet and act from that place. So it's like, try to use equanimity to get over the fear. See where there's equanimity meets the fear, another way to say it. And it's really, we've been practicing it right from the beginning. When you start to learn to meditate, allow this to be just how it is. Okay, body's filled with fear. Heart is beating so fast, I feel like I can't take a breath. Something in me is noticing that, right? So just bring a little more attention to that quality. And that starts to bring a quality of equanimity to it. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. And then by doing that, sometimes you'd be surprised that a situation arises and the fear doesn't arise with it like it used to. And it's like once a fear arises, you can't like, okay, get rid of fear, come back put it, can't sub out equanimity. But by practicing in this way, something shifts, and over time, equanimity has more likely to arise, even in the midst of something which is scary or difficult. It's like, oh, there's this ease in this moment, a balance in this moment. Yeah, thank you for that question. All right, Kathy, go ahead.
Yes, thanks. This has been great, and lots to think about and bring in. And I wanted to know, Tim, about having a, if there's some way to lighten up. You've kind of danced around it, but like the sense of self, if this bit about it's got to be my, it's got to come out the way I want it. It's like there's a big ego possibility here.
Yeah.
And I know I have it. You know, I know how I'd like things to, well, I know how I'd like everything to work out. You know, anything to work out. And yeah, maybe you could say something about that.
Sure. I mean, I could basically repeat what I just said. It's like that when something arises like fear or that ego or that control or that wanting to be, if we don't have that meditative perspective, that sense of being able to sense and observe it, we are in the middle of it. We're lost in it, right? And so, okay, wonder if you don't judge the fact that you are controlling or you want things to be a certain way or you have an ego around this. Wonder if there's a capacity just to notice that, to observe that. That starts to move outside of the terrain of the sense of self. It gets slippery because the sense of self can be really good at noticing itself. And so the terrain gets a little bit slippery until there's a deeper falling away. But just start to, you know, observe that quality. So start to, okay, what's it like to want to control? You know, what's the flavors in the body? What's the flavors in the mind and the heart around it? Noticing without trying to change it. And then it actually starts to soften in that way.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. That's great.
You're welcome. And that noticing, just to connect back with the creativity question, because it's like, so if I start to notice this, like I'm noticing these qualities or these things arising, that's all this receptive kind of, you know, meditative way of relating to it. And then when I actually turn to act, then it's like full-hearted going into the action. Yeah, so it may seem like they're contradictory, but they're actually not. All right, Deb Savinsky. I'm gonna nail her name.
How can you do it? I know it. Slavinsky.
Savinsky. Thank you, Deb. Thank you for your patience. Of course,
So I have a question, and I don't mean this to sound funny, but it might. There are 10 paramis in our tradition, and one informs the other, informs the other, informs the other, but there is a list. Why is it that equanimity is at the end? As important as it is, as helpful as it is for us to be in the middle of things as they are and to recognize things as they are, to be in the present moment, which is what equanimity speaks to for what you're saying and what I understand. Why is it placed at the end? Wouldn't it be better to get a shot of it right up front and set us going, you know, in the right direction?
So why is it the list of the ways? I'll turn that question over to the Buddha and he can answer that one. But basically that the way that I'm going to speak from my own experience or my own sense of it. So I'm not speaking for the big scholarly way. I'm sure there's some people who have looked at that. Why is it laid out in this particular way? But functionally, you know, equanimity is one of those ones that if we put it at the beginning, it might lead to a little bit of distortion. You know, like, okay, I like this idea of me be equanimous, so I'm going to kind of make myself pretend to be equanimous. By doing all these other paramis first, we kind of, okay, we have this quality of loving kindness. We have this quality of generosity. We have this quality of truthfulness. So it kind of helps us kind of not be so distorted by equanimity. We could ask the same question about the Brahma Viharas. Why is equanimity at the end instead of at the beginning? And maybe that's part of it, because as meditators, we can find this place of observation that feels removed. So I've been just talking about encouraging us to do that, but now I'm going to talk about the downside of it. If we stay too much in that sense of observation and removedness, we can feel equanimous. Okay, things are coming and going. But there's this way that it's really kind of, we're kind of deadening ourselves to life. So that's what I would say, is that's one reason that we bring them all, you know, at the end, is that we use all these other paramis to kind of flush out this human condition. And that can be a valid way of exploring it. Also, the paramis are kind of they can go from one piece to another. They can kind of be a sequential supporting as way we've done it. But they can also be just a whole package that we open to all at once. Mm. But didactically, we kind of have to go through one at a time. You know, like the Matrix, if you just could learn it, download it all at once, I know the paramis, then that might be a nice way to do it. But, you know, we have to just, okay, we do one at a time. And then next month, December, we'll look at the paramis as a whole and see how they start to kind of support each other and how they are. But I'm not sure, to the bottom line, I'm not sure why they put them in that order. I'm just making up what seems to.
Okay. Well, thank you. So, I understand. I can understand with the Brahma Viharas why it's at the end, because it does provide a balancing.
Yeah.
Kind of a modifying, kind of, so that we're not arduous all the time, or, you know, passionate. We have a little cooling off kind of a thing. So maybe that's one way to think about it. So thank you.
Yeah, I think the important thing is to notice the effects of it on your own practice. You know, how does it show up to have at the end? You know, how would it have been if I had at the beginning? How might I have interpreted it differently if I just had equanimity without all these others? So that's kind of the bottom line. How does it show up in your practice?
Thank you.
Thank you, Deb. All right, Judith, let's go with you, and then we'll see if there's anyone back here in the room.
I just read that in Gail Stark's book, Joseph Goldstein, saying that in the Tibetan tradition, they put equanimity at the beginning. Hmm. And so he was talking a bit about that, because he considers it to be the foundation of all the paramis. But it seems to me it's also the culmination of all the paramis. So it's like it kind of fits both places.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I think that's a great way to frame it. And I didn't realize that about the Tibetan tradition. I mean, we could probably argue all the paramis, we could do starts and ends, both the start and the culmination. That'd be a nice way of, yeah. Maybe next year we'll do that again. And the paramis also, I think it's important to note that they are actually show up in the early teachings of the Buddha. They weren't like in a sutta with the Buddha laid them out. This came a little bit later in the followers of the Buddha, as they start to kind of flesh things out and add these different qualities. You know, Zen tradition has 6 paramis. You know, we have 10 paramis. Why did they get rid of those paramis? Or why did they sub out other paramis? You know, part of it is just interpretation in the way different people have practiced. So what's helpful, what's useful, what brings your practice alive? That's, I think, always a fundamental question to bring forth. All right, how about back here in the room? Any questions? We have space maybe for one or two more. Yeah.
I know we've been studying this for a whole year, but what does the word paramis mean?
It means perfections.
Okay. That's a challenge. Okay. Just in my thought process. Another thing, I know we've sort of been talking about this, but part of what I hear about equanimity is a sense of non-reactivity. Mm. And can you say more about deadening yourself versus not reacting but paying attention? Does that make sense?
So the two things, your choices are deadening versus...
So you talked about like how you can just sort of withdraw and really sort of be dead to the world.
Right.
Which would be a form of non-reactivity. But I don't think that that's what you're talking about here. And so the sense of being able to discern that in my daily life, not that I'm an economist yet, but hey, I'll get there. But, you know, so that's my question.
Yeah, so reactivity, yeah, I think that's a great way of also framing equanimity, is that we're less reactive, but not in a deadened way. Like, you know, like something like we're paralyzed, we have a nerve cut, so we're not picking up senses. Yeah, we're frostbite or whatever it might be. It's not that kind of non-reactivity. It's a non-reactivity that's come from wisdom and compassion, and also this capacity to open to. And how you can tell the difference is when they feel fundamentally different, right? Like if I'm kind of numbed out or I'm disassociated or disconnected, that there's kind of a, like I'm feeling life through like mittens or something. There's a sense of insulation from life. And there's different reasons that comes up, whether it's a trauma response or things are overwhelming or we're injured or whatever it might be. There's that, the stimulus is too much to hold. So part of it is holding that or respecting that or caring for that well. Mm-hmm. I think reactivity is one of those things. We kind of had this thread throughout the evening. Questions. I've found the best way to become more non-reactive is to really work with my reactivity very skillfully. To really open to it, to sense it, to feel the impulses of it. Get to know the perspective behind it, the beliefs behind it. Get to know, you know, patterns of control, of fear, all these things. And I start to know that landscape enough that I stop being so identified with it.
Right. So it's more a sense of investigation prior to like, oh, I'm done. You know, I'm equanimous. It's more investigating why I would react to some things and really looking at it closely.
Yes. Yeah. And and back to your first question, what does the perfections mean? It's historically what was said that the Buddha spent lifetimes working on these different qualities. And once he got to a certain depth and then they're perfected, and then then that became possible for him to awaken fully. That's one way of presenting them. Mm-hmm. But we can start to see that also as it is as an expression of our awakened hearts. Right, so that, and then we can have the big expression. We can just have small expressions of being a little less reactive, and just like that little story about the founder of Aikido is like we can get a little reactive, but we catch it much sooner. I think that's something we all start to notice, right?
Yeah.
Instead of like getting reactive and making this whole thing around it, oh, I got a little triggered. I open to that. I meet that. I'm not resisting it, and then from there I can actually respond to it. And that's a quality of equanimity in action, is a non-reaction, but the responsiveness. Yeah. Cheryl?
Sure.
We go.
Thanks, Tim. I guess my question has to do with the act of defining all of the paramis, in that these become social, you know, constructs, but it's a definition that kind of intrinsically ignores the negative space in between them. And by trying to teach people these definitions, It's like asking people to check boxes, which may, but without understanding the whole of it, like understanding all the space around it, or for allowing, you know, another paramese to come popping into existence, mm-hmm. or using things that are, you know, hundreds or thousands of years to, without updating them, and I'm not saying they need to be updated, but I'm just saying that it starts to become rigid and lacking in life.
By having a list of 10 and these qualities and like focus on these and not kind of, there are other aspects that might come forth.
Yeah, I guess. I get nervous when you try to define things so much, when things try to be so well defined. That mm-hmm. makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I think, there's wisdom in that, in not getting too rigid in the definition, because when you start to define it in a locked way, we are deadening ourselves to things arising, to the spontaneity of things. And in terms of like the negative space between, and you know, the other things they come up with, I try to hold it as a very kind of broad, alive expression. Like, what's equanimity like? What's equanimity like in this moment? How do I relate to it? What's kind of the shadows that come up around it? Maybe what's another aspect? So I think you can open to it in a really broad way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It starts to get to a right and wrong way of doing it. That makes me always a little shy, I think. But yeah. I just think about it a lot as we're kind of going through these. So I'll continue to pick you with it in a new angle.
That sounds good. So. Yeah, the right or wrong, I think that's one of the downsides. When we put a word like perfection, then if we're not doing that, we're imperfect. Right from the get-go, we got that performance we gotta do. And that's one of those things we navigate with some of these lists. Yeah. Yeah, good. All right, so thank you all for your great questions and engagement. And thank you for your good hearts and holding this time in our country with as much care and wisdom as you can. And I'll be back in 2 weeks. Carrie Peterson will be here next week offering a talk on equanimity. And yeah, please consider joining Tamira and Judith tomorrow night for some, maybe a break from the the ongoing news reporting of where the election is. All right, be well, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks.